Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. And once again, I've raided my contacts database to bring us another guest, an old friend of mine from around the world of transport. My guest this episode is Richard Dilks. He's the Chief Executive of Collaborative Mobility UK. It's a charity that works to maximise the public benefit of shared cars, bikes and rides. Richard has had a long career, known him a long time, and he was Programme Director for Transport at London First for much of the time that I was at TfL. So I was really glad to catch up with what's happening in Richard's world. So Richard, what's happening with shared mobility?
Plenty, Leon, since you ask. Yeah. So its basic point is it's growing and growing pretty fast. Now, it's been doing that for a while. I think the difference now is that it's growing fast from what was already quite a substantial base to an even more substantial one. Whereas, you know, you go further back in time, just even a few years, and yes, you're growing fast, but you're still, your total numbers aren't so huge. But now they are significant. We're just about to redo these figures, so they'll be out of date, and I'm sure they'll be lower than current reality. But, you know, sort of ballparks of heading 850,000 last we measured it, we must be now heading to 1 million car club members, 2.5 million bike share users or members. Again, that figure will now be out of date, just about to refresh it. The scooter trials, we're into the many, many tens of millions of rides across those in 2.5 years. And so we're, you know, growth and scale. And I think we can see some, but only some, of that reflected in policymaking and practice and what authorities are up to, governments are up to, et cetera, et cetera. But inevitably, there's a lag. So I think where we're not, as a set of subsectors in shared transport, shared mobility, is where we deserve to be, really, in the policymaking sphere. That said, we're definitely in a much better place than we were, you know, just a handful of years ago, and things are moving positively.
So firstly, cars on table. I'm a car club user.
Excellent.
They're in the street outside. Why would I do anything different other than just rent time? Works for me for some times. Doesn't work for me for when I'm going to go somewhere for the day.
Yep.
Come back, because I'm paying for lots of hours of idle use, which of course is the reason you don't have your own vehicle, because of the hours of idle use.
Use, non-use. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And what's the average? Is it 2 hours a day that people use their cars for, which is a pretty low strike rate?
Yeah, it is. Of course, like all averages, that masks a lot. So there are many, many, many millions of cars, you know, for which that figure's never attained, nothing like it. And, you know, the average idleness ratio is sort of 95-ish percent of the time it's not in use.
And the other one I always think of is a bit cultural. So, for example, in the US, it's perfectly normal, isn't it, for a little bus to go around 3 or 4 hotels and pick up 3 or 4 pairs of people before going to the airport, and for people to come from the airport,
yep,
3 or 4 other couples and get dropped off. Every time that's ever been tried here in the UK, it's always fallen flat on its face. So dot to dot with National Express. I wonder, I mean, do you see a sort of cultural thing? Does it just work in some cultures better than others?
Well, so it's a great question, because culture and policy, in my view, twine around each other so heavily that pulling the one apart from the other, you know, we can say the Dutch have a great mass participation cycling culture. That's, they just demonstrably do. You've only got to go there to experience that, or you look at the data and that tells you that. But of course, they've also got very pro-cycling policy and practice over, not forever. People may think the Netherlands was always like it is now. It absolutely wasn't, actually. But since the early 70s in particular, and done consistently. So there is one of the interesting things in my role is trying to keep in touch as appropriate with other countries and what they're up to. And the States is, it's been very interesting coming to this job. I came in with a bunch of lazy preconceptions, really, I think. You know, the sort of tremendously car-based, not much going on there. And yes, it is tremendously car-based as a nation, the USA, but there are some real bright spots of very interesting stuff going on, whether it's about equity, whether it's about mobility hubs, whether it's about use of what sometimes they're called paratransit, or these sort of small minibuses you referred to. And now, one of the reasons they've got a big sort of what I might loosely label DRT type sector and employee shuttle sector as well, and those two things can definitely overlap, is tax policy and subsidy policy. So there are pretty generous tax incentives and at state level and also at federal level available for that stuff as a, just a generalization. That, of course, shifts the, you know, the economic goalposts on it. So it's much more viable to do. They also have quite a network of high occupancy vehicle lanes, which of course they can use in lots of circumstances. That helps. And so, yeah, culture, yes. But I think, you know, if you design the policy right and get the incentives there, then often the culture will follow.
That's interesting. And again, you know, I have no trouble doing shared ride on in Uber in the US. I would never think of doing it here. I did, in fact, wonder at one stage, on any sort of shared ride basis, whether in due course the technology would allow you to choose the sort of person you wanted to ride with. You know, either somebody who wants an argument, doesn't want an argument, has a common interest, has common sports interest, you know, so you could ride with an Everton supporter or you could avoid an Everton supporter. There are people who just want to be left alone. There are people who like having a debate. I wondered whether there was ever a sort of subset possible of the technology where you could specify your preferences for your companions.
It's a great idea. That I love. I also like the fact that you might be up for having a ride with someone you would have an argument with. I think most people are sort of trying to head the other way actually at the moment.
I'll tell you where I got the idea from. In the US, you know, between New York and Boston, there's a dozen coach operators. There's a Jewish one and a Chinese one. And so people tend to travel in the clusters of their, you know, the culture or their religion or whatever. So I just wondered, since there were competing operators on effectively fixed routes there, whether with the great advantage of technology, you could set it up. Now, of course, the more you restrict it, the less likely you are to get a shared ride because you're narrowing your choices a bit. But I just wondered whether it could become attractive to have a shared ride with either somebody you had great synergy with or the opposite.
Technology wise, absolutely, you could do that, as long as you've got, of course, people wanting to tell you enough about themselves so that the system or the guiding mind, where it, you know, can make calls on it and offer options to people. Most of the you know, 2+ car sharing, lift sharing sort of sector we've got in the UK is really around employees and somewhat around communities, but really around employees. So I think it's interesting, your question, because mostly all that's been viewed as simply a sort of safety consideration, you know, sort of hygiene factor of let's make sure somebody is a legitimate person to be taking part in this, which is obviously important, but it hasn't gone any further than that, I don't think. I think also interesting, your question is a something I see more widely with shared transport, and I think is part of its success that it does have different variants within it. Now, that's not uniformly spread across the country and so on, but it is something that I've seen bloom in my still relatively short time in role. I always think that's really interesting and to be pursued if at all possible. Things have got to work. There's no point having 1,000 varieties of something if nobody wants any of them. But the private car, which is, you know, the great enemy in many ways, so to speak, certainly in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, it is. And, you know, the need to reduce mileage from that, which is, you know, well understood, but unfortunately not well practiced in the UK yet. That car offers such a variety of options to people and experiences to people. And the people designing, building those cars try hard to think, what do people actually like? And actually, if you flip over into the sustainable transport world, just broadly, you know, right across public transport, active travel, shared transport, and so on, I think we need to spend more time on that. What do people actually like? How do you make this a nice experience for them? How does it, not just in the basic sort of, is there something to get, binary yes, no, the end, is a dialogue, but something more nuanced than that. So, yeah, I really like that question. I think it's, you know, the more we can think about, you mentioned the limit on your car club use, you know, you don't want to pay for idle time. No, sure. There are other models which try to get around that. So that's a classic of where you want some competition, innovation, something to be evolving, to think, how do we better suit people's needs so we can, in particular in that case, help them not own a car, because we know that owning a car leads to mileage, which is the exact thing we're trying to cut down on.
Yeah. And the other one on shared ride, I think I've always felt, is that once you're into the swing of it, it's lovely. But the first step is actually quite a difficult one, either sharing a vehicle with somebody else, or at the other end of the scale, you know, with scooters and bikes and so on. You are always a bit worried, aren't you, of making an idiot of yourself. So the first time I ever hired an e-scooter, which was in Stockholm, I watched several people go through the process of hiring it, getting it out, checking it. And despite watching it, I didn't spot that you actually had to pedal it up to some sort of speed before the motor goes. So I spent some time flicking the accelerator with my thumb, wondering why I wasn't going anywhere. Once you'd got through that, it was a piece of cake. And then after that, you were just sold on it. And some of my colleagues from TfL were eating in a restaurant, so were amazed to see me arrive on my e-scooter and park it on the pavement and photograph it and come inside. And it was glorious. So I've always felt that there's a bit of friction, isn't there, for the early users. Well, once you've got over it, it's good. And I did a similar thing the very first time with the car club. So I have an underground car park where I live. So in order to get the car ready for the job it was going to do, the first thing I did was put it in my underground car parking place so that I could load it. Then I managed to end the hire by mistake instead of locking the car. And since it was now in an underground car park, it was beyond the telephone signal of the operator to reopen it for me.
Tricky.
Yeah.
It's not going very well at this point. What happened next?
I can't quite remember how we did it. I think they sent somebody. But either way, those were all learning lessons. And so I have a feeling that adoption of some of these things, the nearest I can think about it is that there's now an infinite number of YouTube videos about taking your latest electrical gadget or camera or thing out of its box and connecting it and making it work. And I don't see anything like that much for any sort of shared mobility, which is a pity, because once you watch one of those things and you've got the hang of it, then you don't feel such an idiot when you're in action. So yeah. Does research suggest that people are nervous about their first attempt?
So I think this is all super interesting stuff. I think there's a mix of things here. I think there's always onus on the operators to make this stuff as easy as it possibly can be, and then also to describe it as well as possible, whether it's YouTube videos, in-app videos, et cetera, whatever's the most, you know, conducive channel for somebody. It's an interesting conversation. It's making me think. I think we'll have a little look at this. This is me scribbling on my little whiteboard.
Pleased to be of assistance here.
Because it's an absolutely fair point. It's something, of course, comes up in one way, shape, or form all the time. But the particular video points a really interesting one. So there are little bumps in the road to get using something. I would argue there are for any mode, pretty much. So first time you've gone and bought a car, if that's what you've done, and how do you deal with servicing it, and which garage to go to, and what is an MOT and insurance, and you know, and in fact, shared transport at its best, you know, it's taking away lots of hassles. So we want these things to be as frictionless as possible. We see evidence of a related trend in our research. So far we broadly research users, and we do that at scale every year with Car Club and Bike Share, and we have for years. And it's interesting watching what they think is going to be the case when they come into the service, because we ask them about what were their thoughts as they came in, if they're a new user, but then also they report on how they're getting on in it. So cost, for example, in Car Club, it's about a quarter of people anticipating that they're going to save some money because they say cost saving is one of their motives. But there's about three quarters of people saying they actually are saving money. So demonstrably, their understanding wasn't 100% on how it would go, which is true of anybody. How do you fully know what something's like until you've done it? So we see quite a bit of this sort of not really fully understanding it, but we also see it can be very powerful, particularly, I think, the micromobility, because the barriers to getting on it are relatively low, and it's there in your eye line, maybe tangible, And it does tempt people to give stuff a go. So there's a really important link between bike share and cycling more generally. Bike share is really good at getting people back in the saddle. And significant percentages of people have not cycled for a year or more, even for 5 years or more. And despite that, they've been willing to give it a go. The other bit is satisfaction ratings, which we look at, we ask for with Car Club and Bike Share. And they're generally very high, and they're generally low to mid 80s percentage wise, and consistently so. So generally people are, once they're in it, they're getting it and liking it. Definitely some bumps in the road sort of getting going. I think the bigger set of molehills, or are they mountains, is getting people to try them in the first place. You know, the moment that if you're there sort of with your phone trying to work it out or having a hiccup or so on, but at least you're started on the journey and you'll probably finish it. We should have as few hiccups or none as possible for you, but still you're sort of in there. It's the people who have walked past who I'm sort of particularly exercised about. We've just done some research about users and non-users and looking at where they live. They're the same people demographically and geographically. They're in the same place, they've got similar income levels and so on, but one bunch are using it, one bunch aren't, and trying to dig further into what's that about. I think there's a huge amount of just demystification here that we could do with having more of. No. You know, this is how it works. It's a bit of a different thing to just getting the bus. It's a bit of a different thing to just walking down the road on your own. It's a different thing to owning your car.
Lunch with Leon is brought to you by ITT Hub. This year, Leon Daniels is president of the Chartered Institute of Logistics and Transport. If you want your career to really go forward, make sure you are a member now. Go to cilt.org.uk.
One of the mistakes I made in TFL, which I regret, is there was a point with car clubs where they were seeking to come inside the TFL tent. And you might remember this from London First days, Richard, where we missed a trick because there's something, and I'm going to take London as an example, but broadly any regional transport authority that is recognisable, whether it's in Paris or Madrid or wherever, we had the chance and we wouldn't do it to bring them inside the tent so that the roundel appeared on the vehicles and on the signage and on the material. And at the time, we were persuaded, in my view now quite wrongly with the benefit of hindsight, that they were trying to ride on our coattails in terms of respectability. But in fact, what it would have done is broadly done what the TFL logo and the name of any decent transport authority anywhere around the world, it adds a respectability that broadly says, I may not know how this works, but somebody somewhere's got some standards and there's some minimum requirements and the operators will be insured. You know, so there's a whole series of things that I might be concerned about. If it's inside the tent of the transport authority, it must be all right. And we did it right with cycle hire. And I think we did it wrong with car clubs, because instead of being worried about polluting the brand, we should have said, this is a way of making it more popular by adding respectability to it. I don't know whether internationally are there transit agencies that have car clubs inside the tent. And, you know, and the obvious question is, I mean, I admit it to be a mistake, but I'm sure it would just overcome some people's reticence to it.
Yeah. So music to my ears, but rather sad music. Because if you look at where London still is really on shared transport, you know, people are voting with their feet and using it. There's more options there in the market for people than ever before. Growth is there. However, we don't have in our great global capital city, largest city in Europe, our great trophy asset in so many ways of climate change mitigation with transport, just shared mobility viewed more narrowly itself and so on. We don't have it firing all proverbial cylinders by any means. And this is a big part of it, this not being in the tent. There isn't a tent to be in yet from shared transport's point of view, because no one's erected it in this sense. You know, no one's got the guiding mind across it. Now, we spend a lot of time working on this stuff at Coma UK. And I think actually lots of discussions with TfL, lots of discussions with boroughs, with London councils, with operators. I think we are starting to get somewhere and have maybe a little, you know, workable plan coming. But nearly 4 years into this job, and I've been working on that whole time, and it's tremendously slow going. If the round ball was on it, going back to your analysis, it would help hugely. It would help on the policy side of it. It would help in that sense inside the tent. It would help users clearly. Clearly, it would boost respectability, but also just as important, tangibility. It would effectively be a huge promotional tool for that sector in general, an awareness-raising move. It's interesting if you look now at the TfL app, which is a bit stuck, I would argue. It's just stuck covering what TfL does with a bit of walking, cycling, routing stuff as well. I think the challenge is cities fair. You've got to go broader. So Berlin, the tent is very consciously, deliberately been expanded. And if you look at the Yelby app there, it covers all the public transport stuff, of course, but it also covers walking and cycling, but it also covers shared mobility. And there is a rule set, and I would never argue for any old Tom, Dick and Harry being inside the tent. There needs to be a rule set. But so long as you are an approved provider, let's say, it's not the exact German words there, then you're in, and therefore you're going to show up in their mass app, which covers all that stuff. Now, that strikes me as a better weapon set on modal shift than the one London's ended up with.
I hope for my colleagues, my old colleagues at TfL, if they're listening, you and I think absolutely agreed that it would be so much better if the warm embrace of respectability was, to put your point, they erected a tent so we could be in it.
It would drive mode shift, I'm confident of that, well over and above what we've already got. And part of that is also that it helps people, if you can do mass apps that fully integrate all this stuff, terrific. But even without doing that, to your point about Clippers, it's sort of integrated, but actually under the skin, there are some differences. But are they material ones that stop people doing those journeys or enable them? I'd say they're more enabling than disabling. And so even at a journey planning level, you're getting across the point to people, we have a range of options for you. And back to my point about the private car being so competitive, because we can jump in it and go to Scotland right now, or we could go around the corner and we could take three people with us or just go on our own, and we could take luggage or not take luggage, or we could take a dog or not take. It's a lot of use cases that it is a formidable enemy. And so if we can have as cities, regions, so on, this much bigger arsenal of stuff, it's just going to work better. I'd also back that up by pointing to our research, which shows this is what people already do. So we've found this for years. Car club users and bike share users, they use other shared transport modes more once they've come into using the one they're telling us about. They use public transport more. They walk more and they cycle more. And they do that all more than the average for the country, but also for the region. So we've cut it by Scotland, we've cut it by London, and we've cut it by Manchester at different points. It's all the case still. So we're having people working this out for themselves out there. And that's well done them. But what we need to do is make it, much more obvious, easy, doable for lots more people.
I was talking about my first experience on e-scooters. Which was a wonderful experience and terrifying simultaneously. It occurs to me what's happened in the market is that those old definitions of vehicles, push bikes, upwards, is that all the little gaps between them being filled in. Now, in governance terms, it's shocking, isn't it? Because e-scooters were never envisaged when the 1960 Road Traffic Act was drafted. So you end up, don't you, with two-wheeled vehicles with electric motors that are not legal to be used anywhere except on private property. But it seems to me like we're filling in all the gaps, everything from electric two-wheel motor scooters, that resemble a motorbike or motor scooter. E-scooters is a case in point, electric bikes. They're all just filling in the gaps so that there is now two or three or four-wheel solution for just about every place between the top end of walking and the bottom end of an old type motor vehicle. Is that where you see?
That's certainly where the kit is. Of course, that's not, you have made this point, that's not where the UK law is by any means. So we have these socking great gap basically in terms of what the law understands exists from e-bikes to mopeds, roughly speaking. And in between those two, there really isn't much at all. So consequently, we have, as you say, you know, we have e-kick scooters, lawful to buy, not lawful to ride on public highway, lawful to ride on private land, which is an obvious, just a nonsense, and the gun can't go on. So basically, yes, but as a country, we're not yet able to grasp this stuff by any means fully. We can do so. You see some of it happening already. So the rise of e-cargo bikes for both freight use, but also for personal use. You know, as a dad with three young kids, these sorts of things. It's, the car is so often the sledgehammer to crack the nut. Sure. And actually, you've got this big range of stuff, as you're saying, that can do lots and lots of interesting things, particularly interesting in urban contexts.
And do you get the impression that the government is listening but has no capacity to do anything about it because it's something of a minefield and it needs parliamentary time and we're in the last year or so of a tired administration and so on?
It's pure guesswork. Obviously, I'm not in the government. It's just guesswork from my side on the outside. But the last, we're on version 3.0, if my memory serves me, of a transport bill that would cover this stuff. So a third attempt is promised for the parliamentary session from King's Speech this spring onwards. I hope it gets priority because for various reasons, I think the position on privately owned e-scooters is just completely untenable, of having them lawful to ride in almost nowhere, but existing at mass scale out there. There are, you know, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even low millions of them now. Nobody knows, of course. And also, crucially, no vehicle standards on them. But fundamentally, this is something which is easily at the lower carbon end of transport. So we need to be looking at all these options, getting our hands on them and making them work the best as part of the mode shift traffic reduction needs we've so clearly got. And we're just not doing that without legislation. There are other things, pavement parking. There's all sorts that hopefully can still carry on in that. I think last time it just got walloped by all the, Great British Railways et cetera, drama, saga. But it's something that's really important. Also mooted in Transport Bill, shared micromobility licensing framework. So we would have something there that, done well, would make it essentially much easier for areas to have common rule set on how these things should go, common routes to procure them and so on. So there's a big need for it. It does need primary legislation to be done at all well. Of course, that's a precious commodity, but I think it's a pretty pressing need.
No, indeed. Well, speaking as somebody who's still waiting for the outcome of the 2014 Law Commission report on taxi and private hire to be enacted, fast approaching a decade since the proposals were made, my goodness me. So, Richard, I'm reading a lot about mobility hubs. Tell me more.
So I'm glad you're reading all about them, Leon. Hopefully the odd bit might be from ourselves here at Como Towers there, I think. So they are places that bring together shared transport option or options, public transport, ditto, active travel, ditto. Lots of US cities have got going on this, Belgium, Norway, Germany, and so on. The city of Bremen got going in 2003, for example, and now has several hundred. So they can be pretty small. We've accredited a couple. We have an accreditation standard. They are ones in a new housing development. It's a shared EV, pick-up drop-off for shared bikes and e-bikes. Around the corner from the bus stop, so decent signage to the bus stop, decent signage from the bus stop, Bob's your mobility hub. Another one's in High Street in Redbridge, out of London Borough. There's a cafe that's there anyway, bit of planting, bit of seating, bit of bike parking, pickup drop-off, tube is just down the road, signage due from the tube. Or they can be very, very big. Some of the ones in the pipeline, DfT's actually put millions of pounds in, many tens of millions of pounds into mobility hubs, are going to be, you know, real, really big. There's loads of stuff going on with it. I think these things hold huge promise, partly because of the international evidence base, partly because when we spend our time talking, as we do, week in, week out, to lots of authorities and the private sector providers, everyone in the mix, mobility hubs capture people's attention. They can suddenly imagine it in their area. They start thinking of specific locations. And a bit like, I don't know if you saw Lambeth's curbside strategy. It seems a bit odd to be talking about something as geeky as a curbside strategy, even on this August podcast. But I thought it was a cracking example of how to do things plurally and how to think about the real world stuff of, yeah, okay, but where's stuff actually going? What stuff are we privileging and what are we not privileging? So mobility hubs are a way of privileging sustainable stuff but in a way that I think will prove both effective and popular and quite attractive if done right. And that is, in essence, what we're all looking for if we want to see chain, you know, the mode shift happen in transport that needs to happen. So we're convening a lot of people around it. I hope we continue to do work on it. That's certainly our aim. And I think there'll be lots of sort of phases to go through, but the UK is only really at the start of this. I think also very timely because we are, in the midst of having a levelling up and regeneration bill go through, which will could shake up a lot in the spatial planning system. Currently, spatial planning doesn't really talk about transport decarbonisation at all. If you look through the document sets as we're doing, there's precious little in there. So there's a huge opportunity to change that. And if you do, and I think hubs are an enabler on this, our chances of building in sustainable journeys and building out unsustainable ones, I think, are so significantly higher. It's why we as the shared transport charity work quite hard on spatial planning stuff now. I think that sort of fusion is going to get more and more common, I hope. Or we could miss the trick entirely and be here in 5 years' time wondering why the graph has not moved.
I don't think we will be, Richard. I think we're poised for a great leap forward for all the reasons that we've talked about, you know, from the environment to do with space, spatial planning, the sorts of places that people want. And frankly, people doing fewer and hopefully also shorter journeys in the whole ecosystem. So I'm very optimistic, Richard, which I think is great. Well, what a great place to end. Richard Dilks has been my guest. He's the chief executive at Collaborative Mobility UK. That's comoh.org.uk. Please go to their website and take a look at everything that's happening across at Como UK and everything you need to know about shared mobility. This has been Lunch with Leon, which is an itthub.co.uk production. Please go across there for details of what's going on with us at ITT Hub and at Farnborough International. But again, once again, thank you very much indeed to my great guest, Richard Dilks.
Thank you, Leon.